says Iran allows no armed groups to be active near its borders. And the U.S. president approves a new military assistance package for Ukraine, saying Kiev will receive first Abrams tanks next week. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. And Iran's armed forces have held military parades across the country on the first day of Sacred Defense Week. That's an occasion which marks the start of the eight-year war imposed on Iran in the 1980s by then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Different units from the Iranian Army, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, law enforcement forces, and the Basij volunteer forces have participated. In the capital Tehran, a military parade was held at Imam Khomeini's mausoleum, with top military brass in attendance. Representatives from different Iranian ethnic groups, including Kurds and Arabs, took part in the event, or I should say are taking part. Military attachés from countries which have embassies in Iran are attending as well. In September 1980, Saddam launched a war on Iran. U.S. and some Western countries assisted the Iraqi dictator and provided him with advanced weapons. Meanwhile, the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi addressed the military parade held in the capital Tehran. He spoke about different issues, including disarmament of anti-Iran groups in northern Iraq. President Raisi said those groups should be disarmed completely.
Iraq has taken positive measures to disarm terrorist groups. The chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces should send delegations to make sure that armed groups have been disarmed. No armed group has the right to have weapons near the border with Iran. We don't allow any separatist group to carry out seditious activities against the Islamic Republic from anywhere in Iraq.
Raisi also spoke about the Islamic Republic's military doctrine, saying it has no place for war and dominance. He added Iran attaches importance to good neighborly policy, calling for military cooperation with regional nations to maintain security in the region. Raisi said the military presence of extra-regional countries is a threat to regional security. He also said Iran rejects any geopolitical change in the region. He meanwhile held unity among the Iranian people and armed forces, saying that defeated enemies' plans to isolate the Islamic Republic. Raisi pointed to the issue of Palestine as well, saying the normalization of ties with Israel will not bring security to the regime. Our correspondent Matthew Abbasian has been at the venue at the military parade in Tehran and joined us earlier to give us more details about it.
Today, October 22nd, marks the day that the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged an unjust war on Iran, which lasted 8 years. Saddam had the backing of several Western countries. However, he failed to realize his dreams of conquering parts of Iran due to the, let's say, courageous acts of the Iranian nation's armed forces. And this event, this parade, is reminiscent of those 8 years of sacrifices made by the Iranian armed forces. Today in this event, forces from different factions of the Iranian armed forces, including the army, the IRGC, the Basij Voluntary Force, took part in the parade. And then the latest military and defensive achievements of the Islamic Republic are being showcased in the second part of the parade. And what I have to say right now is that the Iranian armed forces today are stronger than ever. That's not what I say. That's what our president, Mr. Ebrahim Raisi, who was addressing the Iranian armed forces earlier in the parade, said. And that's thanks, and that's due to the let's say, self-sufficiency of Iran by relying on its own scientists, experts, and youth who have managed to make the country self-reliant, who have managed to produce, domestically produce, equipment such as drones, missiles, and other equipment.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has returned from New York, where he attended the 78th session of the UN General Assembly. Raisi has brought back home thousands of historical clay tablets from the Achaemenid Empire, Gisumisha Ahmadi reports.
President Ebrahim Raisi arriving in Tehran with another feather in his cap. Back from the 78th session of the UN General Assembly in New York, this time claiming the status of a key player in global equations.
I had meetings with 10 heads of states and also meetings with the elite. Considering Iran's membership in international organizations such as Shanghai and BRICS and the stronger ties that we have developed with neighboring and regional countries and the release of our frozen assets, in all of those meetings our future relations were discussed, focusing on the economy. I told them that Iran is ready to expand its relations and there is great potential.
Adding to that, more great news, announcing that he's brought back with him artifacts dating back to the Achaemenid Empire. Clay tablets kept at the University of Chicago for the past 84 years, which were supposed to be sent back to Iran many years ago.
After more than eight decades, what belonged to Iran is finally back home, making President Raisi's trip to New York this time even more special.
Nine boxes, each weighing 75 kilograms, containing a valuable collection of 3,506 clay tablets documenting Iran's cultural heritage, now in Tehran, to be displayed at the National Museum of Iran.
President Raisi's trip was very successful from many aspects, and the fact that he was able to bring back these artifacts is a huge accomplishment. This is an extremely valuable collection. It represents our national identity. The economic, social, and religious condition during the Achaemenid Empire has been documented on these tablets.
The minister explained that this was the result of the follow-ups by the Ministry of Tourism and Cultural Heritage after the sixth ministerial meeting of the Ancient Civilizations Forum in Baghdad last year, where it was decided that archaeological artifacts have to be returned to their home countries, with Iran leading the way for other countries to do so.
With its new memberships in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS, Iran today has become a key player in global equations, something that was clearly demonstrated during President Raisi's trip to New York. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teenager in occupied West Bank. Victim, identified as Abdullah Abu Hassan, was shot dead during an Israeli raid on the city of Jenin. Mona Kandil joined us earlier at a Ramallah with some details.
After midnight, clashes erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians there. This led to the injury of 18-year-old Abdullah Abu Hassan from the nearby village of Al Yamun. He was shot in the village of Kufr Dan, and then he succumbed to his injuries. Palestinian resistance group of Al-Jihad said that he was a member of the group, Saraya Al-Quds, and that he clashed with the Israeli forces there. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, before raiding Kufr Dan village, Israeli forces had also stormed Nablus, Rafidia neighborhood, and surrounded a house there. Of clashes also that led to the injury of a number of Palestinians and at least 130 suffocated due to inhaling tear gas, according to Palestinian paramedics. The Israeli undercover units succeeded to arrest Khalid Tbeli. He was one of the Palestinian wanted Palestinians and a leader of the Lion's Den in Nablus. So, as you have said, Israeli crimes continue. Raiding Palestinian areas continue on a daily basis. In the first place, to arrest Palestinians who are known for being even members of the resistance groups and even normal Palestinians who refuse the Israeli occupation, who express their anger and the rejection of the Israeli occupation and the nonstop crimes.
President Joe Biden says the U.S. will provide Ukraine with new military aid package and first Abrams tanks.
Today, I approve the next tranche of U.S. security assistance to Ukraine, including more artillery, more ammunition, more anti-tank weapons, and next week, the first U.S. Abrams tanks will be delivered to Ukraine.
Biden was speaking at the White House alongside the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. According to the Defense Department, a new batch of military assistance is valued at over $325 million. The package, however, does not include long-range missiles that Kiev has repeatedly asked for. The U.S. has been leading a coalition of Western states arming Ukraine since beginning of its war with Russia in February of last year. It has provided Ukraine with dozens of billions of dollars in military aid so far. Russia has repeatedly warned influx of weapons will only prolong the war and add to the suffering of the Ukrainian people. UK's first female black member of parliament potentially faces end of her political career after the opposition Labour Party suspended her over controversial comments she made and apologized for a few months ago. Diane Abbott, who has been an MP now for over 36 years, alleges that party leader Keir Starmer is running a fraudulent inquiry into her by smearing her with accusations of racism and anti-Semitism. Saeed Puriza has your details.
Allegations of racism rocked the UK's Labour Party again. On the receiving end, one of its own MPs, Britain's first female black member and a lifelong anti-racism campaigner, Diane Abbott. In April, she wrote a letter to the Observer newspaper suggesting Jewish, Irish, and traveler people were not subject to racism all their lives, and that although white people with points of difference suffer prejudice, they have not suffered the same racism as black people. Comments deemed racist and anti-Semitic. The backlash was immediate. She apologized, but was suspended pending an investigation. Yet in an open letter published on X this week, she's accused Labour leader Keir Starmer of trying to oust her from Parliament by ensuring she cannot stand for the party.
As a black woman and someone on the left of the Labour Party, I have unfortunately been forced to reach the conclusion that I will not get a fair hearing from this Labour leadership.
Last year, an Al Jazeera documentary exposed apparent anti-black discrimination and a hierarchy of racism in Labour under Keir Starmer. An example of that, earlier this year, right-wing Labour MP Neil Coyle, who racially abused a journalist and had a sexual harassment complaint upheld against him, was reinstated after only a five-day suspension. Abbott was shadow interior minister under former leader Jeremy Corbyn, who was blocked as a Labour MP over an anti-Semitism row in 2020. We asked former Labour mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, who knows Diane Abbott, for his take.
She's been a committed person challenging all forms of racism and prejudice. And this was nothing to do with racism. I mean, who is an occasion going to make a mistake in something they say or write? But as I say, this was about getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn, and she was one of Jeremy's longest friends and solid supporters.
Some of her other colleagues are saying that Abbott is being thrown out of here because she does not conform to the domestic neoliberal policy and rejects the ongoing UK imperialist ambitions, that she should not have sought to placate the Labour leadership. Instead, they say, she should have stood up for what she believed in from the start, because there was never going to be a way back for her. Saeed Puriza, London.
This week marks the second anniversary of the Taliban's closure of secondary schools for Afghan girls. Since then, girls have faced increased challenges and restrictions. Rahmatullah Baghban reports out of Kabul.
It has been 2 years since the Taliban authorities banned girls from attending high school. The repressive measure has triggered an educational crisis in the country. Some female students like Fatima Ahmadi, who are left helpless at home, say that the ban order has denied them their rights and halted their progress.
I was in 10th grade when the Taliban shut the school doors for girls. If they had not barred us from attending our schools, I would be in 12th grade right now. This year, I should have been preparing for the university entrance exam, but I'm not, because the de facto government doesn't allow us.
Despite the closure of their schools, Afghan girls are not giving up on their dreams. These ambitious students now gather at a secret school to study every day. They say they still have hope for a bright future and try to defy the restrictions.
We had lots of problems. By the way, we tried our best in order to fight with the problems, and we continued. We never gave up. We didn't lose our hope. So we will continue, and I have a message for all the girls who are hearing my voice that please do not think that you are alone. The world is with you, and you should continue your way, and I'm sure that one day the Taliban or their strategy will not work, and I'm hopeful for our future.
So my favorite field that I want to study in university is business. I really like this field, and also I follow some big business men in the world and also in Asia. For example, Mukesh Ambani is the biggest businessman in India and also in Asia. So I really follow his way, and I really like this field to study at university and then make my own companies and have my own business and then provide jobs and opportunities for girls and women.
This is the UN Children's Agency says more than 1 million girls are affected by the Taliban ban. The agency, however, has estimated around 5 million girls were already out of school when the Taliban returned to power in 2021 due to a lack of facilities and other reasons. 2 years ago, the Taliban banned female students from attending secondary schools in Afghanistan. Since then, Afghan girls who have been deprived of their right to education have been calling on the international community to support them under the current difficult circumstances. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Arrears have hit a 7-year high due to rising interest rates and unemployment in the UK. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the Bank of England data showed that a growing number of British households are falling behind on loan payments, with mortgage arrears jumping by 13% in the second quarter of the year to the highest level since 2016. The value of home loans with late payments rose to £16.9 billion, $21.1 billion, up 29% on the previous year, as rising interest rates and unemployment in recent months have put pressure on household disposable incomes. Louise Shaw, founder of Mansfield-based Shaw Financial Services, told the news agency Newspage, "The speed at which mortgage arrears are increasing is terrifying and should give cause to pause at the next Bank of England interest rate meeting." He warned that a mortgage meltdown was coming unless the regulator changes its approach. The Bank of England has been hiking interest rates in an effort to contain rising inflation, which has worsened the cost of living crisis in the country. However, this makes home loans more expensive to pay back, since mortgage holders are paying higher interest. Shaw added, "This is dire data, and we know that it's about to get an awful lot worse with 1.6 million mortgage holders due to renew over the next 12 months at significantly higher rates than anyone has been used to for well over a decade." The data showed that mortgage lending was also down in the second quarter of the year, with gross advances falling by $7.8 billion to $65.3 billion. Borrowing has shrunk by almost a third in annual terms to the lowest level since the worst of the COVID-19 collapse in lending in the second quarter of 2020. According to recent reports, home sales in the UK are on course to fall to the worst and lowest level in more than a decade as a result of surging mortgage costs. Real estate firm Zoopla reported in its House Price Index published recently. The number of house purchases in Britain is expected to drop by 21% year on year to about 1 million this year, down from 1.26 million last year, and the 14-year high of 1.48 million recorded in 2021 when low interest rates and pandemic tax breaks boosted buying. Demand for residential housing over the past 4 weeks slumped by 34% compared to the average for the last 5 years, as soaring mortgage rates and cost of living pressures weigh on the market, according to the report. It is the number of sales that have been hit hardest by higher borrowing costs, especially amongst mortgage-reliant buyers, said Richard Donnell, executive director at Zoopla. He added, "Cash buyers are more immune and on track to account for more than one in three sales in 2023. A typical two-year fixed mortgage stood at 6.73% recently, while the average five-year fixed contract was 6.21%, according to MoneyFacts. According to Zoopla, the number of house sales funded by mortgages is predicted to drop by 28% this year, while cash sales will remain relatively resilient, falling just 1% in 2023. The report added that rates needed to fall below 5% before we see an increased appetite to move home in the second half. The Bank of England hiked interest rates for a 14th consecutive time on August 3rd, bringing the benchmark that underpins most mortgage lending rates to a 15-year high of 5.25%. Mortgage approvals in the UK dipped for the first time in 3 months in July to 49,444 authorised home loans, according to the latest report from the regulator. According to The Guardian, British cost of living crisis is forcing more people to dip into savings to make ends meet, according to official figures showing renters are at the greatest risk of financial vulnerability. The Office for National Statistics said 3 in 10 people it surveyed were using savings because of the rising cost of living, an increase from a quarter of adults reporting this in late April. Millions of households across Britain are coming under sustained pressure from soaring prices for groceries, energy and other basic essentials, with inflation struck at 8.7% and food and drink prices continuing to rise at among the fastest annual rates since the late 1970s. Highlighting the intense pressure on families, the ONS said 1 in 20 households had run out of food in the past and had not been able to afford more. Almost half of adults said they were spending more than usual to get what they usually buy or had resorted to buying less food. Separate research from Kantar suggests households are shopping around more and changing to cheaper supermarket-owned brand products.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Yemen is marking the 9th anniversary of the September 21 revolution. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi. In the meantime, Yemen has endured the worst Saudi onslaught backed by the U.S. on the country, a war which has temporarily stopped, but not over yet, due to ongoing talks with the Saudi side. Will this revolution bear the fruits of the hardships that the people in Yemen endured? Will outside interference, like from the U.S., prevent this from happening? Ultimately, will there be a peace deal? Just a few of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of the program. First, let me introduce our guest. Hussein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator, joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Saab Shah, author and West Asia expert, who joins us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Hussein Al-Bukhaiti. So it's been a long time now, taking a look back at what has happened here. One of the things that I'd like to get your idea on was back in 2012, if I may test your memory, you had elections that happened there, and you had people that came out to vote. But the problem was that this was a one-man election. You only had, and it's quite incredible, Abdurrahman Mansur Hadi as the only candidate that came out. And of course, we know if there's one candidate who's going to win. I think the people of Yemen obviously must have lost trust, if there was any left, in that process. Can you tell us what your thoughts were, given what happened back then?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. This actually was made up by the Saudi, the so-called the Gulf Initiative, which has insisted that Yemenis must have that national dialogue. And then there was that election because Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, his term has ended at that time. So they said they will extend his term for 1 year. And Ansarullah have actually agreed to that at that time. But after this year was ended, they have done, as you say, one-man election. And he actually officially has won that election. And this show you that what the Saudi actually claim that they are protecting the so-called Yemeni legitimacy is all lies. And we know now that Saudi Arabia has actually put the former President Hadi under house arrest for almost 1 year and a half or 2 years. We don't know what's happening with him. That's actually a clear message to everybody, especially people in Yemen who are fighting in the side of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. They must they must know that Saudi and United Arab Emirates actually they just want Yemen to be divided, and they just want the situation to get worsened in Yemen. But on the other side, they want as well to have peace, not only in Yemen, not on Yemen, but to avoid any attack or any ballistic missiles or drone attack against Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates.
All right, so you had Sabshath, the elections, and then you had Yemen's Ansarullah that moved in and took over the state institution in Sana'a and basically wanted to have a democratically elected institution overall to be there. But then you had the war that broke out. Tell us the reason why you had Saudi Arabia, which led a coalition at that point, backed by the United States, leading this war. What reasons did they have behind doing that?
The Saudi war of aggression were largely supported logistically and politically as well, and even military and training, and then refueling even the air fighters sorties in disguise of Yemen by the United States of America and other. Even nearly 80% of the equipment used in that aggression were supplied by the United States of America. And all the info and all the logistics as well. And 20% came from other countries like the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany. Yemen lies in a very strategic position. This controls the Arabian Sea and controls Bab al-Mandab, which enters the Red Sea, which is over 40% of the energy, which oil and gas goes to the world, and especially the West from there through the Suez Canal. We know anything comes from the Gulf states going in there. And we know as well why the United Arab Emirates went straight and occupied Aden and took over the port, not even to develop it, to make sure it will never function and work, and to make sure all the business stays in Jabal bin Ali and Dubai. In history, we know that the British used to run most of their empire from Aden, from India to Australia. It used to be Aden, which the third largest port in the world, which is give the British that immense control and power. So the United States of America today don't want to see an independent, sovereign Yemen state who doesn't obey the United States of America's orders or directions, or its puppets in Saudi Arabia. So that's why they want to control Yemen, to make sure the whole strategic area is still under control of Zionist Western powers. And Saudi Arabia was acting in their behalf to further that agenda.
All right, so Hussein al-Bugheiti, tell us how much the U.S. interfered in Yemen's affairs. What kind of role and how much of a role it played, which was a destructive one when it came to Yemen?
It was clearly, as an example, in the first year of the war against Yemen, we remember that before Saudi or the so-called Hadi government has moved the central bank from Sana'a to Aden, Sana'a government at that time used to pay the salary. Like 2 years and a half after the start of the war, till mid-2018. And then in some of the talks that was held in Muscat and in Oman, and there was as well the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, he has actually at that time threatened the Sana'a delegation in Muscat that they will cut the salaries and as well they will move the central bank. And this is actually what happened since 2018. The Yemen income from gas and oil revenue has been sold out. The money actually Saudi is using that money in their war effort. They think that because there will be a pressure from Yemeni population against Saudi Arabia, especially not paying the salaries of Yemeni public sector. But what's happening actually is exactly the opposite. And this show you that the United States was actually planning from the beginning to stop those salaries. And as well, when the war was declared, it was declared from Washington by the ambassador of Saudi Arabia at that time. And it's really, really funny that a war is declared against a country, declare a war against another country from a third country. And soon after that declaration from Saudi ambassador in Washington, United States White House has released a statement saying that they will support that war against Yemen. And we've seen what the United States have actually done. They have struck the largest deal of weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and in the history of the United States, to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates during this war. And this actually shows that United States actually is well involved in this war. And if it was not to the United States, especially to the refueling planes that was refueling Saudi Arabia fighter jet across Yemen, Saudi Arabia actually will not be able to continue this war for more than a year. And this exactly shows that the United States is actually willing to divide Yemen. They are willing to keep the situation in Yemen and the humanitarian disaster, one of the largest man-made disaster in the history of the world. And we've seen many outbreak of illness in Yemen. And I believe that if Saudi Arabia actually, they might be actually willing to stop their war, because we've seen so many attacks against Saudi Arabia, but because actually the decision is in the hand of the United States.
All right, so you have this war that started, and many people forget, Saab Shah, as our guests have reminded us, that it was actually announced by the U.S., which is quite unprecedented. And then as the war went on, you saw country after country dropping out of this war. There was a number of countries that were in support of this war and were part of the coalition. They continued to drop out until only Saudi Arabia and the UAE, along with the backing from the U.S., were left. But they weren't able to win the war. And they were so desperate at one point that even al-Qaeda, as a leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement, stated that the U.S. was using al-Qaeda terrorists not only to create divisions within Yemen, but to advance its agenda on the ground in order to beat the Ansarullah fighters, which they ultimately weren't. Why were they not able to beat the Ansarullah fighters, do you think?
Let's remember one fact, that when the Saudis used Takfiri groups and the Americans engineered that actually for them on the ground, that's meant to get Yemen divided amongst tribes and amongst regions, so Yemenis can fight each other. And this is where they were bidden, as the Houthi himself said today. But Yemeni people, as we seen today when they were celebrating the 9th anniversary of the September 21st revolution, they showed a huge military parade in Al Sab'in Square in Sana'a. During the parade, they displayed homemade vehicles, military boats loaded with heavy machine guns, drones, or range of missiles. This all made at home. And while flying in the skies, a war fighter jet and helicopters. That is muscles being flexed in the face of the Saudis. This is a victorious people who has developed their indigenous military industries. And as your guest alluded to, this weapons reach the heart of Saudi Arabia in Aramco, which is the nerve center of all life in Saudi Arabia, and reach United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi. So these two countries who's left in the coalition, they have interest. One of them, the Emiratis, as I said, they wanted to control the south of Yemen with the help of the Zionist entity. And the Saudis is still under orders of the United States of America to stay the put in Yemen, because the Americans don't want Yemeni independent state sovereign who doesn't obey the orders of the United States of America to run that strategic country. Right. And the Saudis as well wanted to take a huge chunk from Yemen and its wealth as well.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now we have enough reminiscing, I guess, about what was in the past. So now we're looking at what's happening currently. And it was in April, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, roughly when we saw the ceasefires take place. And we now are in the phase of talks that are happening between the two sides. But what's interesting was that you had the U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, his name Tim Lenderking, who was very pessimistic about these talks. I mean, he came out and said, quote, "I don't expect a durable resolution, and we should not, to the nearly eight-year conflict in Yemen, to happen overnight." And he said it wasn't something that's going to actually lead to any peace at this point. Some took that to mean that the U.S. did not want for peace to prevail, for there to be a deal. Why was the U.S., or why is the U.S., against a peace deal to happen?
Of course, we know that all United States policy in our region or in other areas across the world, it depends on chaos in those country. As an example, one of the main reasons that the United States actually was interfering in Yemen even before the Saudi United Arab Emirates coalition war is what they said is because their goal is to fight, as they say, terrorism. But if they really wanted to stop that, they can see that Sana'a government actually they are willing to fight terrorists, and actually they have been succeeded in clearing all areas under the control of Sana'a government from all terrorism. But this really clearly that the United States, as you mentioned, with their special envoy to Yemen, which have clearly made it that the United States is not expecting any peace from this talk, because they are actually the one who is in control. But the Saudi Arabia, if they really wanted an advice, they should actually look what is in their favor, what's in their advantage. Their economy is actually, and especially the oil refinery, is under threat from attack from Sana'a. That's why they should take a serious step to stop that. And that's why we've seen in the latest 2 to 3 weeks, in the last 2 months, the Saudi delegation has visited Sana'a, and as well, Sana'a delegation has visited Saudi Arabia. And I believe that this is because Saudi Arabia knows that there might be an imminent attack against Saudi Arabia, especially after the celebration of Prophet Muhammad. And I will just add one more thing.
Sure.
That Saudi Arabia, and they have the so-called Vision 2030. That's why Mohammed bin Salman, if he want actually to put that vision, which is actually started at the beginning of the war on Yemen, to change Saudi Arabia economy, he should actually consider that he must stop this war. And one final thing, we all remember that Saudi ambassador to the United States, who has actually declared this war, have said in an interview that this war was planned with the USA 6 months before the start of the first airstrike. And this is clearly shows United States interest in keeping chaos in Yemen.
Sure. Well, you know, what's interesting here, Sabshath, is this U.S. Special Envoy has also said that the preference here was for the war to actually continue, even as we speak. This is really the U.S. stance. And I want to ask from you, what he has stated is to advance the U.S. and Israeli anti-Iran crusade. Now, what is the deal there? I mean, is it because they want to keep Iran on check, or do they want to control this, as you mentioned, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the significance and importance that that has? They want to control that, but they can't do it with Ansarullah movements in power. Is that the correct understanding or analysis there?
I really appreciate your question. It's a fantastic question. The United States of America invested heavily in this war and used all these puppets in the region to achieve, as I mentioned earlier on, to help Saudis to take a chunk, which is Hadramaut of Yemen, and to annex it. From Hadramaut, the Saudis plan to put an oil like a pipe to reach the Arabian Sea in there, which is will help Saudi Arabia to export 90% of its oil through that direction, which is a Strait of Hormuz will be absolute for the Saudis. And here with the United States of America's strategic plan is to stagnate Iran through the Strait of Hormuz. So the Saudis' oil can go through Yemen, exported. The Emiratis from Fujairah and that areas. So the only country will be in difficulties exporting its oil to the international market will be Iran. This is one major point in the whole of war on Yemen. And the other one is to make the Israeli regime is supreme in the region. As they try to build bases in Socotra and taking control in the little islands near Bab el-Mandab, so they can control all the trade and the movement, maritime movement in that area. So the whole thing is about hegemony and total control for the United States of America and Israel, and more and more besiege and stagnation for Iran.
Sure. Well, Hossein Abu-Khaiti, we find ourselves in a very interesting place when it comes to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia, as you are very well aware, its jewel, Aramco, was targeted by the Ansarullah movement, and they did it so well and on a number of occasions. Many have said that Saudi Arabia expected the U.S. Under the basis that Iran was supplying, which is false. Iran has said, we're not supplying any type of military equipment to the Ansarullah. But Saudi Arabia expected the U.S. to attack Iran. But when it saw that did not happen, hence we're looking now at a landscape where Saudi Arabia wants talks to reach some kind of conclusion. Is that a correct way of looking at it, given the fact that the U.S. doesn't want there to be a peace deal?
I mean, it could be right in some point, but Saudi Arabia, if they are really seeking some conclusion or result in stopping the war and stopping attack against Saudi Arabia, they know the only way, as Sana'a have said, is that the Saudi will stop either war effort against Yemen, will stop this aggression, lift the blockade, and withdraw all military personnel that they are not Yemeni, either from United States or United Arab Emirates. And we've seen that this so-called that weapons or Iran supplying weapons, I mean, Saudi Arabia has been closing the airport and the port for many, many years. I mean, they have been bombing a small fishing boat. It is hard, actually, to get medicine into Yemen, and they show you how false their claim that Yemen is actually getting weapons from Iran. But on the other hand, let's say what they said is right. I mean, Yemen have the right to buy weapons from anywhere in the world to protect themselves. I mean, Saudi Arabia, they are not planting the F-16 or the Patriot or other military equipment in their field. They are actually buying those weapons directly from United States, and they are getting direct help and direct support from United States and UK and other countries. But it has been clearly that actually the main goal or is actually behind this war is United States, UK, and Israel. We've seen that the United Arab Emirates is trying to separate Yemen. They are building bases in Bab al-Mandeb Strait and as well in Socotra Island because okay. I think that, and I'm sure that the United States knows that they cannot actually launch any war against Iran, or maybe there will be a future war or any clashes with China. That's why they want actually to secure the Red Sea. They don't want any country there that's anti-United States policy in the region.
Thank you for that. Last question to you, Sopshot, which I have to ask. You have 5 days of talks that have been reported to be very positive between the two sides. How much of a chance do you give these peace talks to actually yield results? In 1 minute, please.
I think the Saudis just start to shift their position for the Yemenis' demands after the Omani mediator put more pressure on them because refusing the salary issue and the humanitarian issues for Yemenis, it means back to square one, which is back to war, which is the Yemeni Houthi movement to promise massive escalation. And that is, if you go to square one, it means defeat to the Saudis. The other point which I want to make very clear in here, and I hope my friends in Yemen get it, the Saudis in their statement lately took a negotiation talking about themselves as the mediator. They are not the mediator, of course. They are the leading force of this war of aggression. But they're using this terminology to try to escape from reconstruction of Yemen and the course of legal and reparation for Yemenis. Okay. And the same thing. So the Saudis and the Americans have to be zoomed in for their responsibilities of
thank
the war
you.
In Yemen.
Thank you for that. Sopshot, author and West Asia expert from Belfast. Hossein Abukhiti, thank you. Activist and political commentator from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vatahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT-5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaka.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. He was the divinely appointed trustee. He was the divinely appointed rightful successor, and he was the divinely appointed Khalifatullah for the Muslims. We find that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the only representative at the forefront of the opposition to the rule of the corrupt Abbasid caliphs. He was one of the prominent leaders of the Muslim Ummah who struggled against tyranny and oppression. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam took a brave and unwavering position against the tyrannical kings of his age. He did not associate with any of them. Rather, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam preferred to stay away from these tyrannical kings. And therefore, these kings held grudges and an enmity against Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and they inflicted him with severity and violence, ultimately leading to the martyrdom of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyara text of Jamaatul Kabira issued by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawil luha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal ma'rifah.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's Prophet, and the progeny of Allah's Messenger, may Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala ad-du'ati ila Allah wal adillahi ala mardhatillah.
Peace be upon the callers of Allah, the leaders to Allah's pleasure, the abiders of Allah's decree, the perfect in love for Allah, the sincere in professing Allah's oneness, the manifester of Allah's orders and prohibitions, and Allah's honored bondmen who speak not until He has spoken.